Hello, everyone. It's Sidedoor producer Justin O'Neill. Lizzie's out this week, so I'm here with a sad update. In this episode, we feature a conversation with legendary journalist Koki Roberts. Koki passed away in the time since we originally recorded our interview. Our heart goes out to all of Koki's family, friends, and people like us who have admired her work for decades.
This is Sidedoor, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody.
Do I need to get my headphones?
No.
Okay. Don't worry.
Well, I have some.
Just saying.
If you want headphones.
You have headphones. You are a bona fide podcaster.
I know. This
is Kim Sayet, director of the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, and also a podcaster herself. She's the host of the National Portrait Gallery's podcast, Portraits. Today, we're putting Kim in the guest chair to find out more about her new podcast. And while I had the Portrait Gallery's director in the room, I wanted to get one thing straight. So, Kim, let's start basic.
Okay.
Really basic. What is a portrait?
That's not so basic. It's actually kind of complicated.
Huh.
But I think for the point of the Portrait Gallery and certainly its collection, you know, we do begin with the idea of the human face. It helps that they are recognizable. But I think you could argue, and I take a pretty expansive view of portraiture, is that it's also, it could be somebody's voice, it could be even the back of your hair or your head, even though a smell, right? Sometimes when someone walks in the room.
Well, when I think portrait, I think of a painting, but I never even thought about how it could be a non-visual representation of a person.
Yeah, I mean, I even think going back 40,000 years where you had the first people sort of putting their handprints on the side of a cave, there is this desire to actually put some kind of a physical representation of ourselves out there for other people to see.
Hmm. So it sounds like what you're saying is a portrait is really a representation of a specific human being.
Yes. I think that's a really nice way to put it.
Let's get a little more specific. So tell us about the Portraits podcast.
We started thinking about how do we put the National in National Portrait Gallery, right? 325 million people across this country, and how do we have some kind of relationship with them? And how do we tell the stories that are behind all these pictures? So I'd like to think that this podcast will be about those stories and the people that we think we know but perhaps don't know and how we think about ourselves at this particular moment in time.
In each episode, Kim talks with a different artist, historian, or other expert to tell the stories behind a portrait on the museum's walls. As Kim says,
it tells a much larger story.
Right, than what's just pictured in the visual.
And that is true of all portraiture.
Mm.
There's always a story behind the story, which is another story, which is another story.
And on and on and on.
And on and on and on in the circle of life.
So in a recent episode of Portraits, Kim spoke with Koki Roberts about first ladies. Koki is a journalist, commentator, and the author of several best-selling books, including Ladies of Liberty and Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington from 1848 to 1868. She knows her stuff.
She has such a depth of knowledge. And, you know, the first ladies, the founding mothers, is one of her specialties. And so she really knows what she's talking about.
A quick note that Kim and Koki discuss four portraits in detail. And if you'd like a visual reference, you can find links to the images in our episode description and on our website. So this time on Sidedoor, Kim Sayet and Koki Roberts share the stories behind the portraits of four fearless first ladies, including one who brokered power in Washington for more than 40 years. Welcome back, and welcome to this segment from Portraits, the podcast from the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, where Kim Sayet and Koki Roberts talk first ladies.
Cokey Roberts, welcome to Portraits. It's so lovely to have you.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
So we're going to have a little bit of a natter about First Ladies. And I will say that they're the most requested portraits outside of the presidents when people come to the museum.
That's interesting.
And yeah, it is really interesting. Really, it's not till recently that people even knew who the First Lady was. They didn't have a vision of what they looked like. Some people didn't even care. But one of the questions that I have is there is this perception that the reason that we care about First Ladies today is that they have much more of a political voice, they do way more, they've got a cause, you know, they're sort of standing there next to their husband still at this moment. But back then they didn't have to. They could be involved with running the White House and knitting and sewing. Is that true?
No. Not even close to being true. First ladies have been involved in politics from Martha Washington on. Martha Washington went to war every winter of the American Revolution. 8 long years
Wow.
of war. George Washington thought that she was absolutely essential to the troop morale, and troop morale was always extremely iffy, because the American troops went through periods where they were unpaid, unhoused, unclothed, and she would come. She would bring foodstuffs and cloth from Mount Vernon, and she would be cheered into camp. Lady Washington is here. And she would then sew with the soldiers, cook for the soldiers, nurse the soldiers, put on entertainments with the other officers' wives, and just keep morale going. And they adored her. And let's talk a little bit about this portrait of her, though.
Yeah, I love that. So this is a portrait by Rembrandt Peale. It's called the Porthole Portrait. And she is, for all of the fact that, of course, she's older, she has this really beautiful kind of hat on. There's lots of lace and fur belows.
I actually think her hat does her a great disservice.
Really?
Yes. All of the pictures of her that we have any memory of, she has on that hat, that mob cap it was called.
Yes.
And it just makes her look dowdy. And she wasn't dowdy. She was funny. She said things that were totally politically incorrect, you know, bad things about Thomas Jefferson. And one time she came in and saw that there was grease on her wall and said it must have been a Democrat who did that. I mean, she was not this person. Think about it. While she was First Lady and having to create the role of First Lady, which was incredibly difficult, because here we had just come through this revolution
right.
to get rid of a king and all of the courtliness of Europe. And so it was a Republican with a small R nation. And she had to create this role where it was Republican enough to be accepted by the revolutionaries, but elegant and formal enough so that Europe would take this pathetic little country huddled on the Atlantic seriously. She had a lot of work to do, and she felt confined by it. She wrote at one point to her niece, "They say I'm the finest lady in the land, but I feel more like the chief state prisoner."
Yes. But she did have help, right?
Oh,
one
gosh,
of the
yes.
more...
she
you
had
know,
enslaved people working for
well,
her.
Well, she had Oney Judge was one of them, I know. And there was a bit of drama, right, when Oney ran away. And how she didn't deal with that terribly well.
No, because she couldn't get over it. Why would Oney run away? She had absolutely no understanding of it. Oney Judge was an enslaved woman who had worked for Martha Washington for a very long time. And Martha thought she was devoted to her. As far as she was concerned, Oney had a wonderful life. And Oney understood she was going to move back to Virginia, and she would be back in her enslaved position. And so she took off. And Martha was very upset about it and tried to get George to go searching for her, which would have been very indiscreet. And Oney was never found by Martha.
Interesting. And she actually came to the marriage to George as a very wealthy widow. She had 84 enslaved people at the time belonging to her. They actually were not freed until he died. Is that
no, they were not freed until she died. And I must say, the estate, Mount Vernon, has done a very good job
in
letting
yeah.
us know the lives and the contributions of the enslaved people.
So, Koki, this next portrait that's in the gallery by William Elwell, it's of 1848 and it's of Dolly Madsen. What do you see when you look at this?
Well, when I look at this, I see a Dolly Madsen who is about to die, frankly. She was 80 years old in this portrait. She died the next year. But she still has a knowing smile on her face and a look of great intelligence in her eyes. She's wearing one of her signature turbans. She started wearing them in the early 1800s when they were stylish. When she was this age, when she was an old lady, she was poverty-stricken. And so she kept wearing all of her old clothes as a way of just sort of making a statement. She thought she was fooling people that way. But in fact, she didn't have any money to buy new clothes. So the turban was something of a hallmark of Dolly Madsen. She's wearing a black dress with a red shawl. So the red shawl gives you some sense of style. In her day, she was an extremely stylish woman. She wore the dresses of the Napoleonic era with the low necklines and the bosom pushed up. And then these sort
empire
of...
Empire style,
right. Yeah. And then you'll see around her neck in this portrait of her as an old lady, little white sort of netting. Mm. And she would wear that to slightly cover her bosom, to be slightly more modest.
It's kind of too bad that the portrait gallery has all of these portraits of them, all ladies.
Right.
They're all old, yeah, where she was very stylish. Is it true that, you know, as Martha Washington was considered the mother of the nation, that Dolly Madsen was considered Queen Dolly?
She was called Queen Dolly and was very much the absolute power of the city of Washington. Dolly Madsen basically was First Lady of the United States of America for 50 years. She had her own seat in the House of Representatives, and I can actually make the case that she kept the country together at a time when it could have easily fallen apart. The kind of partisanship that we see today was rampant in the early 19th century, combined with vicious regionalism, and the country was way too young and way too fragile to be able to sustain it without some help. And the help came from Dolly Madsen. And she made people come together in the fledgling town of Washington and come to her events and sit down together, have some cider, have some wine, and behave. And she kept them from really falling apart.
And is that because her husband, James Madsen, who was the fourth president of the United States, didn't have the sort of social grace or the
pizzazz? No, it started even before that. When Thomas Jefferson was president, he didn't have a wife. She had been dead for a long time. And people talk about Dolly Madsen as Thomas Jefferson's hostess, and from time to time she did host his events. But mainly she had a whole separate power base at her house on F Street, and she was the person who made people come together, as I said. But also, that then went on for decades. And so Daniel Webster is said to have, at one point, said, there's no permanent power in Washington other than Dolly Madsen. So she was recognized in her time. And I think that's something very interesting. When I went back to learn about these women, I was surprised to see how people at the time gave them credit for political power.
Interesting, because we just don't hear about it
anymore.
That's right. They're seen as, in this case, the old ladies, old white ladies in the museum.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, she's much loved by art historians, and you know why. Because the British were coming, part of the War of 1812, but this happens 2 years later in 1814, and she's left in the White House. Everyone's telling her, leave, leave, leave. The British are coming. And there's a Mr. Carroll, poor man, who's been given the job of getting Dolly out of the White House. It's getting dangerous. And she writes, Mr. Carroll is in a very bad humor with me because I insist on waiting until the large picture of General Washington is secured and requires to be unscrewed from the wall. The process is found to be too tedious for these perilous moments, and I've ordered the frame to be broken and the canvas taken out. It is done, and the precious portrait placed in the hands of two gentlemen of New York for safekeeping. And it is, in fact, a version of the Lansdowne portrait that is still in the East Room of the White House.
So think about recent history. Think about bringing down Saddam Hussein's statue. Think about Lenin's statue. In any war situation, going after the leader, the symbolism of the nation is something that is very difficult to have happen to a nation. And she understood that. And so what happened is the British then did come. They burned their way from the Capitol to the White House, came into the White House. She had prepared, her enslaved servants had prepared dinner for President Madison and his cabinet. The British sat down, ate her dinner, drank her wine, and stole her portrait. And so they probably did unspeakable things to her portrait, but they did not have George Washington to be able to attack.
And we have no idea what that portrait looked like. No. It's lost.
Gone.
That's too bad.
I would never have guessed that Martha Washington was funny. And I don't know how much of that is due to her hat, but I do think of her as this sort of dowdier old woman. And I wonder how much those physical representations factor into our collective memory of characters from long ago.
Susan Sontag said that when you take a picture of someone, it's actually a little death, right? You have frozen time and you'll never get that moment back, and it is just a snapshot of time. And a portrait is the same. It is just that moment. And a portrait is as contemporary and as fresh as the person standing in front of it, even if it had been made 300 years ago. Right? Because you're bringing all of your background and your education and your baggage and your everything, to your personality, to that encounter. But it is only as the starting point. As we like to say on the podcast, it's where art and history, biography and identity collide. And it is not just about that representation of a person, but then finding their story.
When we come back, Kim and Cokie discuss portraits of two iconic 20th century first ladies who couldn't be more different. Today on Side Door, we're featuring an episode of Portraits, the podcast from the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery that explores art, history, biography, and identity through the lens of, you guessed it, portraits. And Kim Sayette, who's the Portrait Gallery's director and podcast host, says that no conversation about America's first ladies is complete without mention of Eleanor Roosevelt. We return to their podcast with Roosevelt's address to the nation as the United States entered World War II.
You cannot escape anxiety. You cannot escape a clutch of fear at your heart. And yet I hope that the certainty of what we have to meet will make you rise above these fears. We must go about our daily business.
Roosevelt had a towering political presence as First Lady during the Depression and World War II, and was instrumental in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. She was an approachable woman, ahead of her time. She even instituted all-female press conferences. Let's get back to our conversation. So, Cokie, let's talk about this next First Lady and this portrait that was done in 1946. What do you see when you look at this?
I see a woman looking at me so directly and so intelligently. I love this portrait. And it's entitled First Lady of the World. And I love that. That was a title given to her, by the way, by Harry Truman. And I think that you really have that sense of her. You have that sense of her determinedness. And at this point, she's at the United Nations. She was, of course, the author of the Human Rights Convention. She was an incredible human being. And she was from childhood. She was involved in every imaginable do-good organization from the time she was a little girl.
She was going to change the world.
And she did.
She did.
Once they reached the White House, of course, President Roosevelt had polio and could really not move around. And so she became his eyes and ears. And she went around the world and the country learning everything she could learn and coming back and telling him. And they often disagreed, and she often pushed him to places he didn't want to be. But she was never going to stop. And I think you get some sense of that in this portrait.
This is a fairly painterly portrait in that you can really see the brushstrokes. And indeed, Eleanor is looking directly out at you. I often call this the power pose. She's got her hair up, which is now silver, into this lovely sort of curled bun, and a beautiful white shirt with a pendant. I do think it's a very kindly portrait, but she is certainly scrutinizing you, and you need to look back.
The other thing I think about it is that I think she's prettier in this portrait than most of the pictures you see of her. Her eyes are so blue,
yes,
in the way they come
sort
across.
Sort of penetrating.
And they really give you a sense of her inner beauty.
You know what's sort of fascinating is that you talk about her as someone who had a lot of determination, she had a lot of courage. In fact, one of the quotes we have of her is saying, "Courage is more exhilarating than fear, and in the long run, it's easier." But she was actually kind of shy. She didn't like getting her portrait done, which was part of the problem that we had, is there aren't a lot around.
But one thing is about other people and one thing is about yourself. And she could speak for other people. To be publicly advocating for someone else is much easier than saying, okay, paint me.
Right. So let's jump ahead to this next portrait, which I think is pretty dazzling. Koki, I hope you agree. This is a portrait done of Nancy Reagan, and it is done in between 1984 and 1985 by Aaron Schickler.
This is her Time magazine cover for the second Reagan inauguration. And as you see, the cut line is White House co-star Nancy Reagan's growing role. And that probably sent shivers down a lot of American spines.
Why?
Because people are scared of first ladies. They think that they have too much power. They don't want them to have power.
And there was a perception that Nancy got a little too involved sometimes.
She was very involved.
And
she,
that's true?
Oh, absolutely. She fired the chief of staff. She hired and fired cabinet. She was terribly involved in running that White House. And the reason people get nervous about that is because they didn't elect her. You know, they elected him and not her. And we, by the way, have absolutely no evidence that any first lady has affected anybody's vote. So not only did they not elect her, but they didn't even really think about her as they were casting their ballots. And there she is, no matter who she is, with the last word at night and the first word in the morning, an incredible influence. And she not only was not elected, she can't be fired.
Yeah, one of her quotes said, "Did I ever give Ronnie advice? You bet I did." And then she goes on to say, "For 8 years I was sleeping with the president, and if that doesn't give you special access, I don't know what does."
There you go.
No truer word was said.
Now,
I have to say, for a woman who was actually 64 in this picture, she's looking fantastic.
She was a very beautiful woman.
Can you describe it?
Yes. This is Nancy Reagan in her 60s, but looking considerably younger, with her hair done, as it always was. She's wearing a red shirt dress with her hands kind of not quite in the pockets, but looking like they might almost be. And she is, again, looking directly at you with a somewhat benign look, but you don't want to mess with her.
No.
And The fact that she's in a shirt dress, I find just absolutely fascinating.
Because that's very modern, right? Very contemporary?
No, it's not that. It's that it's very simple and that it's very plain.
But it's the Reagan red. I discovered that this is a thing.
Oh, the Reagan red was a thing. She told people that they couldn't wear red to the inauguration so that she would be the only one in red. But she is wearing this red dress for this cover to try to look like a plain Jane for Americans, so she's not scaring them. Nancy Reagan was seen as a little bit too hoity-toity for a lot of people. She hung out with Hollywood royalty. She did buy expensive things. She borrowed expensive things, which some people found unsettling.
I think that's kind of smart, though, isn't it?
It was considered somehow common.
Huh.
So it's funny. She was both common and too regal at the same time. But that's what happens to first ladies. You know, Martha Washington loved satins and silks. But when she went to New York to assume the job of first lady, she wore homespun.
Yeah. So if we just circle back again, there's been a whole lot of misconceptions about the first lady. One of them is that really it's been the contemporary first ladies, or at least the 20th century first ladies, that have become more involved in politics. Nancy Reagan certainly comes to fore. But in fact, the early first ladies, the first mothers, were just as involved.
Absolutely. You can go down them one after another and find that there was something where they were instrumental. Sarah Polk, the wife of James Polk, was the cabinet secretary. And, of course, Edith Wilson ran the government after Woodrow Wilson had his stroke. So you just keep looking at them, and the more you learn about each one of them, the more you understand how incredibly influential they were.
And that adage that behind every great man is a truly exceptional woman?
Not all these men were great.
That is fabulous.
If you want to learn more about the first ladies of the White House through their portraits, you're in luck. The National Portrait Gallery is developing an exhibition called Every Eye is Upon Me, which will open in November 2020, and it's going to be pretty special. It's not going to be comprehensive.
It is going to be comprehensive. Every first lady will be in it. We're having major loans coming from other museums. We have big hopes that some of those pictures will come from the White House.
Wow.
So you'll also see some portraits that just haven't been out in the public for a long, long time. So it should be a really, really terrific exhibition.
That's very exciting.
It's very exciting.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us about portraits and about the podcast. It's been a real joy.
Well, thank you so much. And I hope that everybody listens. It would be very self-affirming, if nothing else.
Kim says this season of Portraits is full of great stories, like Civil War spies, the truth about Pocahontas, and how a portrait can restore humanity. Subscribe to Portraits wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. If you like the show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell us why. Side Door is made possible with help from people like you. Your generous support helps make all the amazing work you hear about at the Smithsonian possible. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Jason Orfanon, Michelle Harvin, Caitlin Schaefer, Jess Sadek, and Lara Koch. Episode artwork is by Greg Fisk. Extra support comes from John Barth and Genevieve Sponsler. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. Special thanks, of course, to Kim Sayette and Ruth Morris, and to all the folks at the National Portrait Gallery who helped make this episode possible. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening. Side Gore is made possible. That's good enough.